Well, Jim, that got people talking.
It did, didn't it, Dara? I mean, look, the whole point of this podcast is to get people talking, is to get people discussing Atlantic salmon. And if we're going to prod a few bears occasionally with the odd contentious guest, or shall I say guest with a contentious opinion, then so be it. I think that's the whole raison d'etre.
Yeah, I think it needs to be clarified as well. John and Paul are not climate change deniers. They're not science deniers. What it was, and I got the sense of when we spoke to them, was it was just the frustration that they feel that there's so much focus maybe over the last 30, 40 years on habitat conservation, and they don't see anything changing. They don't see anything getting better. And, you know, they're looking for just different ways of coming at this. They're kind of frustrated, saying, is there any way we can approach this differently? Is there any way we can think of it differently? Can we come up with some different solutions? Because what's being tried isn't happening. And I kind of got that sense of listening to it. And maybe some people didn't. Maybe some people, you know, thought, oh, they were just being too black and white over it. But I don't think that's the way it needs to be listened to. And maybe it needs to be looked at the bigger picture in terms of kind of the frustrations that they were feeling.
Exactly. It's desperate times call for desperate measures. And everybody's got an opinion on that. And so they're entitled to. So I stand by a lot of what Paul and John say, and certainly from a podcaster point of view, I think it's absolutely essential that we invite as open a discussion and as a broader spectrum of opinions as possible when it comes to the plight of the salmon.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, key thing to realize here as well, is there's a lot of salmon anglers in the community who are voicing doubts or concerns or frustrations that we want to reach out and hear from them, because at least then if we're starting to kind of raise what the kind of questions and what the doubts that people in the salmon angling community have, well, then maybe we can address them. Maybe we can kind of say to, well, look, here's another point of view, or here's another point of view. And if everybody, you know, we're all coming at it from the same perspective as, you know, as fans and as lovers of the wild Atlantic salmon that we want to see survive. If we can be cognizant and aware of other people's opinions that they're voicing, well, maybe we can take it into the fold and develop it and bring it on.
I couldn't agree more. It's very, very easy, isn't it, to... It's all very well disagreeing with somebody, but I think if you can offer a counter, a solution, something that gives your argument a reason to be voiced, then all the better for it. And I think that brings us on neatly to our next guest star. Who do we have in this episode?
Well, we have the incomparable, inestimable, all the other ables that I can
all
think
the superlatives,
of.
All the hyperbole that you can chuck at her.
You know, we talk about people making a difference. You know, and this podcast series is about wanting to inspire and engage people to try and make a difference. Well, if there's one woman who's the shining light, or one person who's the shining light, it's Alexandra Morton, the salmon scientist, the author of Not On My Watch, the woman who pretty much single-handedly set up the blueprint for getting rid of fish farms from BC. And my God, there's so much we can learn from her. And Jim, you haven't been to BC for your fishing TV show.
No, not that particular fly fishing show. No, Dara. There's a few phone calls that are still, that have still been left unanswered. Anyway, moving on.
And here is you, Jim, actually quoting from Simon Setra, who was the co-author of The New Fish, who we're actually going to be speaking to later in the series, which is an incredible piece of investigative journalism into the dangers, damages, and consequences of fish farming. And here's you quoting Simon when he talks about Alex Morton.
Yes, Simon Sartre, in his great book, The New Fish, which I know you've read, heralded you as a warrior and said you were feared, loved, admired, and despised all in equal measure. And he quotes you, and I just want to read this passage out because I think it does far more justice than I will ever do to introduce your activism, Alex. You say to Simon, did I choose to become an activist? The alternative was indifference, choosing to believe I was helpless. Here's how I see it. When the machines of big industry are advancing, whether they're clearing forests, damming rivers, or changing nature to grow themselves, the researchers in the field can see the cracks forming in the ecosystems. And little by little, it's broken apart, that fabric of life. In slow motion, we're forced to watch the destruction of nature. Activists are fighting against extinction. This is how you were introduced into the world of salmon farms. I didn't waltz into their salmon farms. They waltzed into my area. And the industry's response to that is to call me an activist. In that case, activism is honorable in my eyes. It's liberating because you don't let anyone else take advantage.
Well, I just would say to people, who are afraid of activism is that it feels really good, because otherwise you're a victim. To the fishermen who are on the river, well, you really see what's going on. You really do know. You can't hide from it. It's not words to you. It's what you're seeing. And my feeling at this point, in the evolution of our species, in the day and age that we are in, is that every one of us who knows the truth about the destruction of an ecosystem has a responsibility to do something about it. But furthermore, it feels really good. It feels so good to push back. And, you know, all the years of the activism that I did, I'm constantly thinking, how do I get people involved? Because the truth is, if enough people stand up to anything, it will change. It's just a fact of life. And I know it's more than 100 people. It's probably more than 1,000 people. But at some point, that number will make a change. And so for the individuals out there who think that they don't matter, well, don't buy that line. That's not true. And that just serves the interests who don't have the ability to see that the natural world is absolutely essential. So figure something out, or when there's a call to action, jump on it. And if you can't physically be there, don't send the message saying I'm with you in spirit, because it doesn't mean anything. Buy a bus ticket for somebody else. Donate some money. Do something to support the people who are on the front lines. It's so important right now. And I can tell you, it works. We did it here. I mean, really, 35 years of banging my head against this wall, finally the wall crumbled. And we're seeing salmon and herring come back in numbers that we really didn't expect to have happen so soon.
35 years, you know, it's a lifetime's work pretty much. And it's so incredibly commendable. And what a legacy to be leaving with regards to your work with the salmon. Can you tell us a little bit, because we're obviously, we have the issues of Atlantic salmon farms, open pen cages, and it really is coming into the fore. There's a lot of awareness around it now. Never have more people been boycotting buying it in the supermarket. So what I'm saying is traction is being gained, and due to all the sort of terrible things that have happened recently in Iceland, that's bringing the welfare of the fish and the welfare of the wild fish to the attention of the mass media. That's great, but that's all very well. But you touched upon there getting people involved and getting them off the bench of apathy. You know, being there in spirit is not enough. Just throwing it back to Dara, who is perhaps, for the sake of this podcast, certainly he's the man on the bench with apathy and indifference and overwhelm. There's too much. What can I do to take on this massive multinational business that is this industry that is salmon farming? What would you say to them?
How does a lion catch a zebra? So zebras are covered in stripes, and when they run in herds, they're very confusing. And the lion might look at them and go, oh, I don't know what to do. But the way to catch a zebra is just pick one and go after it and go after it and go after it. Do not get distracted by the size of it. Just take one step at a time. For example, if you're an angler and you see salmon in your rivers covered with sea lice, or you see an Atlantic salmon in there with a huge open sore, photograph it, pin it on a map, get it out there on your social feed, send it to the people who matter, send it to your politicians. Your local politicians are probably the most susceptible to what you have to say, but don't just see it and walk away. It's really, really important, because there's so many things going wrong with our earth, but there's a lot of us. There's a lot of us who see it. And the other thing I just want to say is the salmon farmers cannot fix their problems. As the First Nation leaders in my area that I live in began to take the reins of this thing and began to control the industry and signed agreements with Maui and Cermak, and Maui and Cermak now had to answer to the leadership. Let me tell you, they wanted to control their sea lice, absolutely, but they couldn't do it. And one of the lines that we hear, like there's an article out right now in the big publication IntraFish, which talks about salmon farming around the world. And Cermak is saying, oh, well, all those herring that we blew their eyes out and damaged, and, you know, it was a one-off. No, it's not a one-off. You can't let the industry start telling people what is going on, because they never tell the full story, because they can't control the wild fish that come into the farms. They can't control their sea lice. And the viruses and the bacteria are having an absolute heyday in the farms. They're so excited to have all these fish to infect and mutate and pour out. And there's nothing the farmers can do about it. I've watched them try to deal with their problems, and they can't do it. So just, you can't be swayed. They just need to get out of the ocean, just to create a solid barrier. Well, really closed containment on land, because we all know the ocean eventually breaks everything. Cermak, Mowi, and Grieg, these three Norwegian-based companies, are really the only farmers we have in British Columbia. They are now suing the government of Canada again to reverse a decision to remove their farms. This is how they respond. They're threatening, they go to court, they spend money on lawyers, but they don't spend money on trying to fix their problems. I mean, really, the industry at this point, I mean, over half the industry has been removed from the waters of British Columbia. And the industry could say, okay, look, we don't believe that there's a problem with us, but clearly we've lost social license. So here's what we're going to do about it. They never take that approach. They're just threatening schoolyard bullies, and they're starting to look ridiculous. Everyone knows who they are. They're not easy to work with. They're a bit nasty.
Why do you think they are? We find it obviously the same over here. It's the same business, right? It's all the same. It comes from a handful of Norwegian businesses on the whole. Why are they so defensive and therefore aggressive to deal with and litigious, rather than holding their hands up and going, we need, you know, we understand that we're playing a part in some environmental destruction here, and we will do what we can to invest in ourselves to fix our wrongs. I mean, surely that's the right business approach.
Strategists who told them years ago, don't ever admit to any problem. If you do get caught out, say that you've changed and you're improving and that it's getting better. And then tell everybody that the coastal communities absolutely will fall apart if you leave. And so they just say these things over and over and over, and it's worked well for them, but it's not working now because, well, you know, you have people jumping on the farms and taking videos inside the farms. That's what really turned it around here, and everybody could see what was actually in the farms. And I think they're just following a strategy that has worked, and they're not nimble enough as an industry to change and respond to the fact that people actually know what is going on. The veil of secrecy, the lights have been turned on, and we can see it.
I suppose as well, Alex, isn't it? It's certain industries get too big, too powerful. It's the tail wagging the dog in many respects, in terms of politicians and governments are, you know, jumping to the tune of what these multi-billion global corporations say, and that they've been allowed to get into that position. We see it. Do you think we're at a tipping point? You know, and I've brought this up before. We spoke to Mikael Froden about it, you know, in terms of what he's trying to do with salmon farming in Scandinavia, in terms of his protests. Jim mentioned Iceland. But are we being a bit... I'm going to sound like the negative Nelly here. But is the danger that Iceland, we've mentioned this before, Iceland's a small country, you know, it's a smaller population, that local communities, maybe it's easier to kind of pass the message around and kind of get people gathering to protest. Whereas internationally, whether it's, you know, the UK, Western Europe, North America, is it harder to mobilize and go against industries in such a bigger scale?
The answer to that question is yes. But the other thing I would say is that you can be very effective on the local basis. So this industry depends on every single farm. Back in 2009, I visited Norway and did quite a bit of media. And at the end of my trip, the last night, the CEO of Maui called me in for a private meeting. And she said to me, "What do you want?" And I wish to this day that I'd said $1 million just to see what she would do. But I didn't. And I said,
she had given it to you.
Yeah, I said, "You just need to get off our wild salmon migration routes." And she said such an interesting thing back to me. She said, "Look, I have to make this company grow 4 times a year. And I can't affect the share price and I can't affect the market price." Well, maybe they are actually. But I can affect how many fish are in the farms. And I need more fish in the farms every single month. So that's when in my mind, I was like, okay, you just need to get out, because they're never going to be satisfied with one farm, 10 farm, 1,000 farms. They need more farms. And so what that tells you on the local level is any farm that you close, you are affecting the whole industry or that company at least. And at some point, maybe they will decide that they want to be responsible operators and they will seriously develop closed containment. But what I'm hearing from the operators who are trying to develop closed containment is the big open net farm companies are suppressing them and making their lives difficult. So they're so good at that strategy, they don't want to upgrade and change in a way that would be so much better for them. But whatever. So they, in many ways, make it easier for us because they're big and they're brittle and they are not going to, you know, move off their song sheet of "we're getting better, we're sustainable, we're going to use area management." I had to laugh at the CEO of Maui's comment to Iceland when they had to kill their own fish because of sea lice. And the Maui CEO said, "Oh, this will never happen again." "Oh yeah, buddy. I don't know who you think you're talking to, but we know you and we know your industry. You haven't been able to control these sea lice ever."
Can I ask you, Alex, just what about the top-down approach? You know, like if we say we're targeting local and local communities and what one person can do, like I look at it from a EU level. Like if, when it comes to environmental change or, you know, like water habitats directives that the EU has brought in, which have been very powerful in terms of putting the onus on governments to ensure there's clean river fresh waters, to ensure that the livelihood of the fish, why aren't we seeing it at a top level, I think, even at an EU level, to kind of take on these the corporations of the big massive fish farmers? Because it's obvious the science. It's obvious that there's growing opposition to it. And that's where I kind of tear my hair out going, when are we going to see the political impetus and the political want to actually engage with this issue?
Well, we're starting to see that here now. We finally had our premier of the province of British Columbia just the other day say that salmon farming is losing its social license. And he was responding to the massive amount of herring that are being killed in these farms. But this is a really good question. And it pervades all industries. Somehow our governments don't want to protect us from the very things that are destroying this planet. I believe there needs to be a new court developed in The Hague that will review the fraudulent science that industries like this are using to try to pull the wool over our eyes and say, "Oh, this virus is not causing disease," or "this virus is not from Norway." Because this is so dangerous. So I think you need to work top down. I think it's very important to bring your politicians along. But the EU some years ago now actually allowed an increase in toxins in farm salmon food. I believe the drug was, or the pesticide was endosulfan, which is one of the Dirty Dozen. And the industry argued that they they needed to be allowed to have more in their feed. It's heinous. This is hurting children. And so I don't know where our politicians are at. I have always suspected that the problem has been the relationship between Norway and Canada. So in Canada, we have an Access to Information Act, and I have accessed thousands and thousands of pages of documents of government talking, but recently, I've been looking at Canada's discussion with Norway, and I can see that, you know, the closure of the salmon farms in my area in the Broughton was being discussed in the embassies in Norway, between Canada and Norway. And of course, Norway is a big oil producer. They're a country that's known for how they can extract oil from difficult places. Canada has some very difficult to get out oil, the oil sands, and Statoil was a big player there. They've pulled out now. But I think that the problem for salmon and for all the people who understand the value and the need for salmon is that there's layers on layers on layers, and the politicians can't even see the bottom. They can't even see what's happening in the world. They're playing a big game up there of you know, shuffling around the deck. So they need the local people to say, look, we're just not going to elect you again if you don't pay attention to this.
I mean, the problem we have on that front when it comes to aquaculture is, I mean, as you know, we're podcasting from you know, not from Scotland, which is where 98% of all salmon farms, certainly around British waters, are. And you know, it's a different government up there. It's very, I would say, eclectic and a bit niche. And obviously has its own economy. And aquaculture brings in revenue. It creates jobs. That's always the hard and fast defense, right? And it does in somewhere like Scotland. So getting the communities up there, I mean, don't get me wrong. They exist and they're constantly reaching out to me and pulling their hair out and going, there's a license going through for a new farm going off Orkney. We don't want it. The locals don't want it. What can we do? And, you know, there's only so much advice I can give from the south of England. So the activism that we're talking about is even more challenging, perhaps, because it's more remote. And whilst we have the power of social media, what we can't do is be lobbying our local MPs about aquaculture, because do you know what I mean? It's not even on their agenda, sadly. So it's a tricky one, but I think because of all the information that's coming out, all the tragedies that have happened recently in places like Iceland and Norway with regards to salmon farms breaking up and escapees and all the rest of it, there is suddenly a bit of an international community that aren't necessarily localized to the farming issues. It's just how we harness that power, because we, you know, lobbying MPs is tricky when it's such a disparate group of activists. So I think that's what we're grappling with now. And that's why you see the like fantastic Bjork, you know, releasing anti-salmon farm pop songs. Amazing. And all these things are starting to happen. It's coming part of the popular culture, but it's tricky, isn't it, Dara? We were talking about it, to get to collectivize us when we're so spread out and very few of us are actually its effective.
It is. And like for me as well, is that the salmon angling community, fly fishing is niche enough. Salmon angling is niche within fly, you know, it's a niche enough sport. So trying to get people to care about one thing here when there's so many other things over here going on with the planet, I suppose, is part of the issue. But I do bring it back to what you said, Alex, is if you can just start with one change, start with one person. And in fairness to my indifference or apathy, which I disagree with to a certain extent, I think I'm more a case of, oh, the system is rigged against us. How can we fight it? You know, are we just banging our head off the wall and is it pointless? The more I talk to you, Alex, the more I read what you've done, and even talking to Jim, the activist anglers, the more I'm inspired by what you have done in terms of being proactive about it. And actually, if you wouldn't mind, actually, there's a quote from your book I wanted to just to read back to Alex. That was, doing nothing requires thousands of decisions to look the other way. To withdraw your hand, clench the change in your pocket, scoff, duck, lie, and feed the very thing that is killing us. And I love that, because it's very much about, by doing nothing, you're making a decision in one way or the other. So maybe it's easier to go the other way on it. But do you think, and I think if we can take it back maybe in terms of, I'd like to, we'll delve more into the salmon farming maybe in a little while, because we've touched on it here. But I would like to bring it back a little bit to your actual activism days when you, as a teenager, you wrote about where you just knew you had to somehow reach out to the animal kingdom, somehow look after them. And, you know, you obviously started with whales, and then, you know, the salmon farming became an issue because of where you were. As a teenager, I was just, I'm always struck by people like yourself who are so driven. Is that just an internal thing that just you found as a kid was just inside you, that was just an inner drive no matter what? Because I would love to have something like that. Like, where did that come from?
That's interesting. Yeah, it's a gift and it is internal. But it sprung from the fact that I was such an awkward child, and I never really could keep up with the cool kids, or I was just drawn to the natural world. I just loved being in the forest. I loved the frogs and the turtles. And I could see that animals were very confident in their communication. And so I just wanted to learn about how they communicated. But while I started reading all the books written by people who went into the wilderness and did these things with chimpanzees and elephants and hyenas, and I realized their books were always in three parts. And part one was this incredible adventure and discovery. Part two was invariably, oh no, it's all about to fall apart because of something we humans are doing. And then part three was the endless treadmill of trying to get government to turn this around. But I just wanted to say, so 35 years of trying to work on this, 30 years, I thought this was an honest system. I thought that if I did the science and I published about sea lice or the spread of viruses in our supermarkets and all the rest of it, that the regulators would change. But what I learned was that, okay, yes, you do need that work. And I have to say to people that are looking at this industry, most of that work has been done and there's a lot to draw on. But in the end, it was the very effective form of activism called occupation. And in an occupation, you simply put your body in the way of the very thing that is destroying part of our world. And there's probably many different ways to do it. But what was successful for us was a code of ethics where there was no violence. There was very, very little swearing. There was no vandalism. There was just this resolute, you are not going to move us until you start taking these farms out. And what happened then was the government, when this went on for 280 days in the winter and people were building small houses on the farms, mainly First Nations people, companies were afraid to touch. Finally, the government was like, okay, we got to deal with this. This has gotten too much. So I'm not suggesting people need to go and occupy the farms, although that is what worked. Nothing else worked. But there's also the supply lines, how they move their feed, how they will, if they're building a new farm, where's that coming from? Who's building it? If you can find the point at which you can just stand and maintain a presence, and the media will ignore you for the first 10, 20, maybe the first 2 months, but at some point they can't ignore you because it's just too interesting, and make sure that you look great, you know, whether it's signage or your message, or be creative. You have to be somewhat of a street artist. So, I mean, these are difficult things I'm suggesting, but writing letters and doing the science and going to the government meetings, all those things just didn't work. They were important and they built a community of us. But in the end, it was, and this is not a great measure of democracy, that it takes this form of revolt. But that I have to just tell you, I mean, that's what we're in Eastern Canada. They just write letters so far, and it's just not working. And I keep telling him, you need to go to court. You need to do something. And it's very important not to be violent in what you do, because you'll just be immediately dismissed. And they will call you name, and they will discredit you, and they will be threatening. But you know, when I get called a warrior, I really want to tell people actually what I am is a grandmother, and grandmothers have often have a, we have a long history of standing up for this planet, for the younger ones, because we have less to risk, right? We're not in the childbearing years. We don't have all these household things to manage. Our lives have quieted down enough that we can take this role and try to support the young ones who do this kind of work as well.
Isn't that part of the problem maybe, Alex, in the sense of, because you mentioned the grandmothers, is that people are working, they have families, they don't want to be seen to be risking that kind of stuff. So it's nearly, I'm not saying it's easier, but you have less to lose, like you said, in that respect. But it's interesting though, when you're talking about the nonviolence, and it's very Martin Luther King-esque, isn't it? Like in that sense, in terms of the protest. You know, immediately when you talked about that, the occupation, I immediately thought of Martin Luther King and, you know, and how that worked in terms of the civil rights protests. And it's just something that you wonder, do you feel frustrated in terms of trying to say to people, this is what's needed, and actually knowing how many people would actually be willing to go that step further? It's easier to write letters and it's well and good, but to actually go to that next step of actually putting their body in the line.
Well, here's the thing, though. So what happened here was one man stepped forward, and it was a First Nation leader, a young Indigenous chief, Ernest Alfred. And we were in a meeting after lots of work. There'd been temporary demonstrations on the farms and all kinds of things. And he said, I'm going to occupy the farm in my territory until it leaves. And that was a lightning rod. And so then a lot of us became support for him. A lot of other First Nations joined him. It takes that one person to go first. And then everybody's like, yeah, that's what needs to be done. Because the frustration and the lack of success, it just wears a person down. But if somebody tries something new like that, it's electrifying. And
it's a brave gesture, isn't it, that inspires people. And how brave of him to go, I'm going to go and camp literally on a farm until I convince them through attrition, I guess, that they've got to leave the area. And I'm just thinking, you know, what can we do?
That is up to you. I mean, people have to decide. I don't want to be responsible for giving you ideas that go badly, but you have to get outside.
But I always went to my grandmother for good advice.
You got to get out there, honey. They have to see you. One of the things I just want to say is people, if you suffer a little bit, like I did a walk that was several hundred kilometers, and by the end there was 5,000 people, but we started out with just a few. If people saw it every day and we were posting on social media and it just went on and on and on. And by the end, people were just leaving their car, abandoning their cars and joining us. And we were this massive group and we arrived on the Parliament steps. But it didn't work because we went home the next night. If we had camped on the yard and the police had to come and remove us, and I mean that might have worked, but it's very hard the difficult part is to decide exactly what you're going to do. But once you've decided that, just stay the course and don't let them convince you that you have no power, because you really do. It's like Greta Thunberg's with her activism. I don't know that it's worked yet, but it certainly started small and it became huge. And, you know, like when we were sitting out there on the farms, a couple of us had dogs and some people would just send us dog food. There was so many ways to help. There were people who started to sit in front of the offices of the politicians who were responsible for this. And so then we became two occupations. That was incredibly powerful. We were extremely remote. Our cell phones barely worked, but we worked very hard to communicate with the other First Nations and other people. And that was a big part of the job, was to bring everybody else along with this. And well, Ernest is just a gifted speaker, and he was fabulous in making things clear. But it's such a dangerous moment we are in this planet, and we know that politicians and our governments are structured to protect corporations And we know that many of our corporations are destroying our chance to survive on this planet. So we all know something has to happen. And when you start with salmon farm, you don't know how big your effect is. It's so important to do in your local community. But certainly the more people you cannot alienate, however you will. I mean, I've gotten all kinds of, you know, really nasty responses from people because I've affected the ability of their family to make a living. The people that are caught in the crosshairs, they got kids in school, they've got medical bills, they have all these things. And for them, an interruption of jobs, even for a few weeks, is going to be very difficult. So what we found when we drilled down is this industry is mechanizing rapidly, and that the job argument was just not was not true. It's so few people in most countries rely on this industry. It's ridiculous.
There's so much bullshit that these people, excuse my language, but so much bullshit that these companies willingly put out there. I mean, it's the more I dig, the more I read, the more people I talk to, it's, you can't help but be angry by the level of lying and corruption that goes on, can you?
I know, that's right. I just posted on my Facebook page a response to Cermak in Intrafish, who's saying that this destruction of all these herring in this one area was basically a one-off. It just happened in that area. No. Any of us who go and look at you see this. And this is part of the protection of this industry is really nobody sees it. Because they're so remote.
Yeah, because it's under this.
Yeah. Yeah. But I was out there in my boat. And so I've seen a lot of it. And they are liars. And what's so interesting is that the more I go after them for that, or the scientists, the government scientists whose science is fraudulently protecting this industry, they never sue me. When I published the book, Not on My Watch, the publisher was very worried that I would get sued or that they would get sued. The industry never said a word about it because it was all true. I'm very, very careful. When I say something about the salmon farming industry, I imagine myself standing in front of a judge and the judge says, "What is your evidence?" And if you don't have that evidence, don't say it. But if you do have the evidence, say it, say it, say it, say it. Because I don't know what role salmon play in Scotland, but here in British Columbia, you know, they're feeding the trees that make the oxygen we breathe. They're an incredibly important species.
Well, we spoke to Simon Setra, Alex, when he mentioned, you know, in terms of like you talk about the kind of the dirty tactics as well. And, you know, he mentioned big oil and he said salmon farming is nothing, or big oil is nothing compared to the salmon farming industry in terms of the tactics and what they'll do. But also really interestingly as well is when he talked about kind of the amount of investigations they had to do for the book, he said he'd never done so much fact-checking to be just 100% watertight in terms of how accurate they were in terms of that book. He said they spent more time on that than anything else. And of course, the usual kind of accusations were thrown at him when the book came out. But I suppose from our perspective, Alex, in terms of kind of, obviously ours is, focuses on the Atlantic salmon, but maybe just might give people a kind of idea of the successes you've had in terms of with the Pacific salmon, in terms of being able to close down salmon farms and being able to kind of move them on. Can you give us a snapshot in terms of kind of just around the area, in terms of give people an idea of how successful you have been?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the Broughton Archipelago, when they closed the farms, there was a river called the Hadda River that's right, it puts its juvenile salmon out right into a salmon farm. And so the fish, when they were tiny, some of the Pacific salmon leave the rivers when they're like that big. That run of fish increased tenfold in one generation. And then this previous summer, we have a huge river called the Fraser River that's down at the southern end of the province. And all the farms were removed from their migration route and they returned this year. And we have a commission who does test fisheries where they send out a large boat to catch fish. And that's how they get an idea of how many fish are returning and whether they can open a commercial fishery. They had the biggest test sets on pink salmon in their history. Nobody was prepared for the amount of fish. And then astonishingly, so I live on this bluff, and that's why the sun is now pouring into my face here. But for years and years and years, I never saw a herring ball. I saw them in the 90s, these big, massive congregation of birds, and then the whales appear. And they just stopped occurring. And with the removal of the salmon farms, suddenly there were herring balls all summer long that lasted for hours. And we had a huge congregation of humpback whales coming to feed on them. We'll have to see what happens with the herring, but the herring is really an untold story, because what we didn't know until we started putting cameras in the farms was that there were millions of herring, not only in the farms, but all around the farms. And they had become addicted to the dust that rolls when the pellets roll down the long tubes, and then they're, you know, flung into the pens. Lots of dust comes off the pellets, and it's flowing into the water and sinking, and the herring, you can see them feeding on it. So they became addicted to this. So they weren't migrating. They were vulnerable to predation because they were along these big nets. They were going into the farms where the Atlantic salmon are clearly eating them. I have video of that. So the impression I'm getting in watching this rebound is that the impact of the industry was even bigger than I knew. It's astonishing. And the salmon farming industry is terrified of this news. They're actually, you know, putting out things that, you know, they always say I'm a zealot, or I'm not a scientist. I publish in the journals, but this news for them is just the worst news ever.
I mean, and on that note, obviously what we can do and what we are doing, whilst we think of something more attention-seeking and divisive, like you said, is we are certainly spreading awareness about to anyone who will listen to boycott buying it in the supermarket, yeah. To boycott eating it, especially this time of year. It's December at the moment. You know, over here, it's traditionally a Christmas. Well, I don't know where it came from, that tradition, because I don't think it's very old, but I would imagine the salmon farm probably, just like they did with sushi,
I think it was a marketing
decided
ploy.
That salmon is a Christmas dish. It's a marketing ploy, but it's, you know, it's very heartening, and it's great that you can tell somebody the story of how an Atlantic salmon finds its way to your plate, and how they'll very quickly go, well, do you know what? I'm not going to eat that anymore. And we have the proof, like you say, and the facts and the science behind it, and the imagery and the video, you know, the scary video footage. And that is making a real difference. And I think to hit them in the pocket at the consumer end. And I just wanted to ask your opinion. Did you ever approach the supermarkets over there or the fishmongers who were selling this crap and say, well, listen, do you know what you're doing, and try and attack it from that angle?
Yes, I did a little bit, but there was this First Nations man, Eddie Gardner, and he did it month after month after month with a small group. They were very polite, so they never got kicked out. They had little information packages that they handed out, and people were really interested. They weren't yelling and screaming because, you know, nobody's going to walk up to somebody who's yelling and screaming and say, what are you doing? They're just going to avoid you and try to get on with their day. But if you're, you know, helpful and look approachable. And so they did this. The problem that we had was that most of the salmon being farmed here was being sent to California and to Asia. But if we had been able to get that big enough, that would have been huge. And one thing we did do is there was some really sick salmon that were showing up in the supermarkets here, the emaciated ones, ones with large open sores or deformed faces. That all stopped. And I don't know what they did with those fish, whether they went on to become dog food, but we did change what they had in the market. And you know, taking pictures of the fish in the market. And then I did a lot of disease testing and found that this blood virus was in virtually every single salmon in the markets, because the companies wouldn't let me go to the farms. So I went to the markets. I even went to sushi restaurants because those fish unbelievably people are eating raw farm salmon that hasn't even been frozen here in Canada. I don't know what the rules are in Scotland, but yeah, that was completely revolting. But anyway, I knew that those fish had been handled well, and so that preserves viruses. And so a lot of my testing was done in sushi restaurants. When the public's hand is deciding whether it's going to buy that package of highly fat farm salmon, they need to know they're making a decision that reaches into the fjords and lochs of their community and their or the land that they're living on. And they need to know this is a very big decision that they're making, and it's going to it's going to have huge ramifications what they decide.
Well, all I can say is I don't eat it. I tell anybody that I know not to eat it. And you hope word spreads like that, at least in one small way.
It's interesting. It's a very simple and effective trick. I've been doing it for years, as everybody I know has, once they're aware of salmon farming. I don't know whether it's the same over there, Alex, but what I find more often than not is the people that don't really, they sort of listen, but they go, oh, I'm still going to eat salmon because I eat salmon every Friday and I'm not going to change. The older generation, I don't know, maybe my parents' generation, they refuse to believe that, you know, there's anything wrong with salmon farming. And I'll tell you for why, because they'll tell me that they'll get it from up, you know, in this country, it'll be Marks and Spencer's or Waitrose or some high end, you know, like Global Foods in Canada there, some reasonably high end, self-assured outlets that they trust implicitly. So, which brings me back to the point, you know, obviously I'm no fool. I know that supermarkets will sell, you know, stack them high and sell them all day long if they're making profit out of it. But there must be a way that we can sort of shame these suppliers, for want of a better word, into having more of a moral responsibility about the food that they're selling. It's not just about, well, the demand's there, so we're just the suppliers. You know, they have a moral obligation. And we saw a change in chicken farming, which over here is how we, but battery chicken farming was how we used to, largely how we used to farm our chickens in very cramped, very anti-welfare states. But now we're using that as a metaphor for this farm salmon. And that's working as well, because as you said earlier, these fish under the sea, out of sight, out of mind in these remote places, you know, it's fine. People don't mind. But actually, if you give them a metaphor and talk about battery chicken farming, that really can make a difference. So whilst I think about your great advice about what we can do, you know, like the First Nations and yourself did by actually camping on the farms, which is just inspired and fantastic. I think certainly we got to keep pushing, the consumers into awareness and to boycotting buying this stuff, not just because it's bad for the environment, because it's bad for them. And, you know, a lot of them don't know that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. You do need to push on all fronts because you don't know which one is going to produce. And I think that the older generation is really suffering because they let all this stuff happen. I mean, an enormous amount of stuff happened, and they almost don't want to believe that it's as bad as it is because they let it happen. But as far as reaching them, you might need to find an access, whether that is a grandchild aged person, a child, or whether it's somebody their age or it's a celebrity. You have to try to find the people that they trust, because they really shouldn't be trusting their supermarkets. Everybody needs for us to watch, and the supermarkets will respond. They want people to come in and buy their food. They're not trying to force feed people farm salmon. So the markets will respond, and it's up to people to make that happen. But I know it's a very, very tough battle, and you just need to think so creatively of how you can convince these people. And it's not yelling at them, as you know. Everybody has like this off switch, and particularly as a woman, I know that if I start yelling, I've lost. Because we all have an off switch for a yelling woman, even us women do. So it takes so much creativity. Yep. Do you know what a Rubik's cube is? That three-dimensional.
Yeah.
Well, it felt like my mind was that person in the corner of the party doing the Rubik's Cube. I'm always like, you know, how do you communicate the damage of this? How do you stop it? How do you reach them? What do I do next? Who do I talk to? It takes a lot of thought.
There's no one more experienced than yourself to answer this one, Alex. We ask our guests, how would you spend £1 billion, euros, Canadian dollars, whatever, a huge amount of money, how would you spend it for the plight of the Atlantic salmon?
Well, I would go find the politicians who have been bought by the salmon farming industry and offer them more money to take those farms out.
I wonder what the number would be.
I do. I wonder that too. Like, how cheap did they sell out for? Probably not whole lot.
Because Trump was $5 billion, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But then I would go to the rivers and I would make them good for salmon. And then I would watch salmon so closely. That is what I have done in my work, is I watch the fish and see what they need, see what they are telling us, follow them where they go. There's some amazing science now where you can read their immune system, which is basically like the fish talking to us. So yeah, just take a note from how the salmon farmers have achieved this and just find those weak politicians, just pay them more and start getting rid of the farms and then listen to the fish.
That's great. That's inspired. So, but so top the bribes that are being currently taken by the politicians from aquaculture, brilliant, and learn more about fish. What's not to love about that? I'm all over that. Let's start the money, the petition right now.
If they had no money, so I suppose this is, you know, for listeners, what can they do? You know, and you talk about creativity and, you know, what can we come up with? What would you advise people? So without spending any money, what can we do to help the plight of the Atlantic salmon?
Well, that was the position I was in. And you just have to use your own body, whether it's standing in front of the supermarket and informing everybody what they're doing, or whether it's standing on the supply line where the feed trucks are coming and just blockade them and post a picture of yourself on social media so that you get out there, talk to the politicians. Just don't stop. Do it at a pace that you can maintain, but don't stop. Just keep going, keep trying different things. And you will hear later how many people you inspired when you thought it was a dark, dark situation and there was no hope. You will hear later all that you did, but you don't know that while you're on the front lines, while you're standing there, while you're embarrassed to be there in front of the supermarket, while you're afraid to be there on the road where the trucks are moving the feed. You won't know, but just, it feels so good. And one of the things we found with the occupation, the hardest thing was for people to go home, because it was so invigorating and powerful. Even as people were, you know, losing jobs and marriages were, you know, suffering, and there was all this chaos, there was this deep sense of doing something right, of not being the victim, of standing up. It was actually good for our mental health to be bold, honorable, and immovable. These are really good characteristics.
Hearing your story, Alex, there's a lot of parallels, I think, with Jim as well, the activist angler. Jim, you were inspired, or you were asked to get involved by neighbors, I think, wasn't it?
I mean, actually, this feeds in perfectly to what you're saying. What can you do for, you know, if you don't have any money and you feel powerless for whatever cause that you're championing? I think similar to you, Alex, this was a few years ago now. I live on a river in the UK, which I'm very passionate about. It's a chalk stream called River Itchen. And my neighbors who own stretches of it came to me and said, look, there's a salad washing factory in the headwaters at the top of the river, and that we have reason to believe that they're releasing their cleaning chemicals every night into the river, because we've been taking kick samples, we've noticed all sorts of you know, species and the whole river ecology basically slowly collapsing, and we have reason to believe this is playing a big part. Can you help us, because we're not massively au fait with social media or setting up petitions or whatever it is, lobbying. So, you know, I said, yeah, of course, because it's something I was reasonably passionate about. And that very quickly grew. And you realize that if you tell the story, if you tell the truth and you get the word out there, you, there's a huge amount of support of like-minded, conscientious, decent people. You know, that, that is most of the world are decent people. I strongly believe that it's the few that we need to conquer in these situations. And we did. I garnered thousands and thousands of signatures very quickly, which led to a petition in government. Anyway, long story short, that salad washing plant no longer exists. Obviously the river faces other challenges now, but they're gone. It's a great example to anybody listening that if you think you're powerless because it's just you, listen to that story. Listen to Alex's story about yours was the same, right? Your neighbors came to you and said, we're noticing something different in the returning salmon. They're dwindling or they're sick. Can you help us with the science? Can you help get the word out? Can you help us compile a story? And look what you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't quit. Because you don't know when you are just about to win. There is no roadmap for this kind of thing. And but there's no salary. So the other thing I really, really suggest is that you take care of yourself and make sure that you can be in this for the long game. But that's such an inspiring story about getting that changed. And I think it's important for people to know that. People are just so starved for news that they can make something right.
People are looking for something to hang their hat on. That if you can give them something to fight for, something to believe in, that they can go, yeah, that's my thing. You know, so Jim, whether it was just even that small fight, you know, that big, that mushroomed into something.
It wasn't that small at the time.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to denigrate, but in terms of, it mushroomed into something more.
No.
You know, and like you just said there, Alex, there is no roadmap for this. Just find a little kernel that you can just chip away at, and then who knows where that will lead to. And I think it'll give people a sense of purpose and drive as well.
Absolutely. And this is good for your mental health. We are all suffering from feeling like victims of some crimes of unimaginable scope, like what the oil industry is doing. Of course, I think the way to fight the oil industry is not with the industry, but just people need to stop using it and they'll stop digging it up. But in any case, it's very, very important to humanity right now to put your body in the way of the things that are killing off the children, our grandchildren, this planet, the wildlife. It's absolutely essential. And once you take that step, you feel great about yourself. It's so liberating. It's better than doing almost anything.
Activism is incredibly good for mental health. I mean, I can vouch for that. But listening to Alex, that, you know, for that reason alone, get active.
Yeah.
Is it like we're reconnecting almost with nature by doing this? And that's why it's feeding into our good mental health. You know, we're plugging back into the system. Like
the salmon farming industry would like you to believe that those fish crowded into the pen, depending on fish that are being caught in other oceans and ground up and packaged and shipped and thrown into the water to make less fish. They want you to think that's the viable system. But the viable system, the big team, is Mother Nature. And when you step over the line and become an activism to protect Mother Nature, you are on the big team. You are an immune response by this planet. You are part of something that has worked since, you know, Earth was first formed. You become part of nature. And she wants you. She needs you. And
she has
planted the seeds in you. You know what needs to be done. And so really, you are on the big team. You are helping the future. You're helping children. You're helping the wildlife. It's so important.
Do you ever see yourself going back to the whales?
I am doing that right now. It's unbelievable.
Yes! Because,
yeah, I know. It's
finally.
So the last half of the salmon farming industry needs to be dealt with. And there's a lot of people working on it now. I don't need to do the virus research. There's incredible virologists on this. I have no sway with politicians, but there's people that do that are talking to the politicians. And so I'm here to help anybody who needs me. But this has become a side of the desk thing for me. And I am going back to, I'm digitizing the whale recordings that I made 41 years ago. And it's just, yeah, it's, plus I'm watching the whales out here and the salmon return and these herring balls. And there's not even a word for how good it feels.
This is what this podcast, this is what we set out to do, Alex. We didn't want to just make another podcast and filling the world with more doom and gloom. We wanted to tell stories of hope and stories of solutions. And to hear this is joyous. It really is. To hear that you have, here you are 35 years, 40 years later since the beginning of this journey, you're now looking out at the sunrise there in BC, looking at the orcas, looking at the returning Pacific salmon because of work you've done. What a joyous end to a story, or certainly end to a chapter, should I say.
The next chapter would be interesting.
Well, the next chapter is you coming over to the UK and Iceland and fighting for our salmon over here. You just don't know that yet.
No, I look at what Iceland's doing, what you guys are doing, and you're so on it. The industry, though, is getting more aggressive because we're squeezing them over here. So I'm sorry, we've made them more aggressive, but they're not as big as they were. So there's that.
It's true. I feel like for the first time in ever, really, that we're starting to see a little bit of buckling. And I think we really need to keep we need to just keep increasing the pressure.
Otherwise they will reconstitute and, but that buckling is happening and, they could change and maybe somebody wants to farm on land, but it's definitely not these big Norwegian companies. They have made it very clear. They're not going to clean up. They just want to make fistfuls of money by externalizing all of their costs. And they really don't care what happens outside the pens. They don't.
As one of our uplifting final questions, if it was the last day on Earth and the rivers were all in much better condition than they are now and the salmon stocks were where they used to be, where would you choose to flick a fly or throw a spinner or whatever it is, however you catch your fish, where would you go? Which river and who would you take?
I would go to the Hadda River, a river that I fought for so long and is now reviving itself, and I would take my dog. We're a good team up there. Yeah, it's a beautiful unlogged watershed. The grizzly bears are there, the pink salmon are there, and the smell is just unimaginable of it in the fall. There's this mint that you can smell, and the salmon, and I love it so much.
I've had the privilege of fishing up there in BC and up even in Terrace and on Vancouver Island and all around there. And it's just the most beautiful, beautiful experience you can ever have as an angler, really. And, you know, what you're saying, it's utopian, isn't it?
It really is. And we all know when we get out there how right this is and how healthy this is and how important it is. And so fighting for it is an honor, really.
Can I just finish up with just a quote from your book, Alex, which I thought was just resonated with me, and I hope will resonate with listeners as well. I decided I was not going to be shoved off my life's path. I was going to plug my ears, ignore the issues, and follow my dream to the end. I was going to decipher the language of some large-brained non-human species, creating a Rosetta Stone of sorts to end the solitude of my species. We needed to hear what another animal on this planet was saying, I thought, because it seemed that we were going mad in our isolation. A lofty aim for a teenager, I know, but this is what I wanted to do. Of course, things are so much simpler when you're a child, and so I failed to stay true to my 15-year-old self. What I didn't realize back then was that if I ignored the impact humans were having on the animals I had chosen to study, I would end up studying their extinction. Are you a lot more hopeful now in terms of having gone on your life's path, your life's journey, or this chapter of it, that we're now actually looking to potentially a better future?
I absolutely am. Yeah. Those whales are feeding well now. And matter of fact, they've stayed in the area much longer than they normally do. And last night, one of the families from the Broughton that had been dispelled were heading in at sunset. I'm much more hopeful. Of course, there's so many problems. It's huge. But addressing them where you can, as you can, is essential. And so, yeah, I am, my heart is just bursting with hope and gratitude that I was able to play this role and to see, you know, there's no big, there's no pension that comes with this. There's no raise, there's no promotion. But when you look out your window and you see the fish that you fought for so long returning, that is the ultimate award and fuel to keep going. And so I always need to have to figure out like how I'm going to earn my money. But the important thing really, really did happen. And so I have to think of the right word for this because it's more than happiness. But it's realizing that you've become a force of nature. You've become a force of nature because this is the natural system that I was able to play a role in helping.
I mean, you've left us speechless, not for the first time in this podcast. It's truly inspiring listening to you, Alex. Genuinely, genuinely. I knew this was going to be an important podcast, but just how important, I had no idea until now. And long may your whales keep returning because you deserve it and they deserve you.
Thank you very much.
Please continue because you are an inspiration. Like you said, sometimes in your darkest hour, which I know that you're well and truly through now, but you don't know how many people are listening. Lots are listening to you, I promise you.
Coming up on the next episode of The Last Salmon,
we go to Scotland, to the very heart of salmon fishing, and talk to Spey Gillie Robert Mitchell about changing times.
Looking back, it was just a great thing, and there was so many fish. It was first on the list, you know, that's how you sold fish, and that's how people came to the river. Number one was to catch the salmon. And there are still magical moments to be had in the river, but they're just a little bit less.
But fishery scientist Colin Bull tells us about new stocking measures that give him hope for the future.
I do believe that there is a future for salmon. I'm not one of the people that think it's going to go extinct. I don't think that's going to happen, personally. We have got a long way to go to get to that point, just because of the biology of the fish itself.
Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to give us your feedback, rate, and review. We want to open up the salmon discussion to you.
And keep fighting for the salmon.